Testing, testing. Got it. Thank you. My brain's a little short on the technical side of things. So I always do what I'm told. So this afternoon, we're going to talk about some of the latest research on male-female differences in brain function. And I had lots of fun with that. I always give Pastor Yulden a bad time, however. Every chance I get. I got that from my father, who was a preacher, and he told me a merry heart is good medicine. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. So he said to me one day, you know, Arlene, you're adopting my sense of humor. And I said, well, girls are often like their fathers. Yes, he said, but not, you can't tease every preacher. Some of them have no sense of humor at all. Which I found out later on. So when I meet somebody who's healthy enough, you know, men love to tease if they like you. And girls sometimes say to me, but he's always teasing me. And I said, he likes you, for heaven's sake. Men don't waste any time teasing people they don't like. Really? So when I find a preacher who is healthy enough to be teased, I'm merciless. So he reminded me that next year, September, correct? We're going to meet in Fiji. And he said, we're going to be doing some stuff together. I'm not exactly sure what that entails, but we'll have a good time, and you can bet your bottom dollar I'll be teasing him. Okay. So this is brand new information. I've only presented it once before in my entire life, and that was earlier at someplace or other, Lenny. Don't remember where, but anyway. It's fabulous. And I'm going to have to go very, very quickly because they don't want me to go past lunch hour. So these slides are on my website. And my website is just www.arlenetaylor.org. And on the left side, you will see a place that says PowerPoints. And if you want the slides, we're going to make these available to you. They're going to put them in PDF so they can be mailed out if you want them. Oh, no, they have to bring a stick, right? You're not going to email them. Even if it's a PDF? Okay, well, then you got to bring a stick if you want it. Otherwise, you can go to my website and you can look at them. All right, epigenetics and cellular memory. Human beings are a mix of nature and nurture. I'm sure you've heard of that. Nature involves genetics, the stuff you get from your parents, the genes and chromosomes that decide in part how tall you are and what your skin color is and how much hair you have and all of that stuff. But the new research is that your genetics only accounts for about 30% of how well you are and how long you live. Okay, 30% is almost a third, but it's only 30%. And I often hear people say, well, I can't help it. You know, I got bad genetics from my parents. This is the way it is. No, it's not the way it is, unless you choose. That's the way it is. So your genetic inheritance involves approximately 46 chromosomes. We may talk about that. And on those chromosomes are about 25,000 genes. In the late 1800s, when I was studying at Loma Linda University, we were just starting to develop a genome. And we thought there'd be at least 250,000 genes. There aren't. There's only 25,000 about. And those 25,000 contain the blueprints for who you are. Now, chromosomes, you may remember, are those represented by the double helix. You know, somebody got the Nobel Prize for figuring that out. And then, like rungs on a ladder, here's all your genes. Every single person on the planet is different, including their brains, because they never get exactly the same mix of anything, even identical twins. And because every thought you think changes every part of your brain, and we never think the same thoughts, we get more different as we get older. So you might have fun with this. You know, here's usually, and when we used to believe that men always had one X and one Y chromosome, and women had two X chromosomes, get one from each parent. And here's a chart of what they look like. And then you come down to the 23rd pair, and that's the X chromosome, and that's the Y chromosome. But we're getting more sophisticated equipment, and we're learning that it's not just an X and a Y. And that's what's so fascinating. Some women only have one X, 45 total. Most women have 46. Most men have 46. But you could have 47, 48, 49, 47, 48, 49. And there's even more variation in a male than there is in a female. And you're not going to know when somebody has a different chromosomal pattern. But it's fascinating that we thought we just were XX and XY, and that's not true. And there's probably going to be more identified than that. Now, when an egg and a sperm connect, you have conception, more than 95% of those little embryos are going to be templated correctly based on the blueprints in their genes. But about 4%, a little bit more percent, won't template correctly. And those are the little babies that are born with what we call birth defects. Now, by 12 weeks into pregnancy, all of the body organs are in place, all of them, including the brain. The brain then creates the mind. And then your mind can tell your brain what to do. And that makes us totally unique for any creature, other creature on the planet. The brain, however, is going to continue developing probably till age 27, 28, or 30. So your brain is not done until well after the body is done. And sometimes young people don't realize that, and they make decisions when they're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, that by the time they get to 30, they wonder, why did I do that? Because that's not working for me now. So now that we know the brain takes so long to develop, I tell young people, slow down. Don't marry the first person you meet. You know, 10 years later, it might not be working for a mature brain. So nurture involves epigenetics. How many of you know that term, epigenetics? Okay, a few of you. Well, learn it, because it's more impactful even than genetics. Epi means above genetics. Epigenetics can impact even genetics. So epigenetics account for 70% of how well you are and how long you live. So genetics is important, but it's only 30%. 70% is everything that isn't genetics, which is your lifestyle for sure. And so one of the reasons we're learning about this information, even about sleep, is because, for example, sleep is independently linked with how long you live. You can be doing lots of good things, you lose sleep, it will impact the length of your life. You can control that. And that's why epigenetics is becoming so important, because it's worth 70%. Now, epigenetics starts impacting you during your gestation, when your mother was pregnant with you. And what we're learning is, if a mother had a very, very stressful pregnancy, maybe she lived in a country where there was a lot of war, you know, and she had to flee for her life, her body will be flooded with stress hormones that will also flood the little growing baby's body. And some of those babies will be born and they will overreact in stressful situations for years after they were born, because of the way that the brain and the body got templated during gestation. So we're starting to learn how important it is that if you want a healthy baby, you have to be really careful about this pregnancy and live to the best of your ability at the highest level of health and wellness you can, because it's going to impact all your body organs, immune system, and your brain while they're developing. We're also learning some other things that are fascinating. For example, this little developing fetus knows if it's wanted or if it's not wanted. It knows if it is the right gender. Did the parents want a boy and they got a girl? The fetus knows that. It knows if the environment that's around its family is happy and pleasant and affirming, or if it isn't, if it's argumentative and a lot of discord. It knows what that environment is going to be like when it's born. Now, gentlemen, don't think that this is all about the woman who's pregnant, because we just got some very interesting research. It is not just maternal stress that can impact this fetus. Studies, University of Maryland on mice, and anytime you do studies on mice and rats, it seems to translate to human beings, because their little brains, you can't tell on a microscope whether it's a rat neuron or a human neuron. Those little developing neurons, you in the rat use about 30 of the same neurotransmitters that human being brains use. So we're pretty clear that that research will translate to humans. So they found that negative or chronic stressors can alter the father's sperm, so that when that sperm fertilizes the egg, that alters fetal brain development. I'm just staggered by what we're learning. What you do before you have a pregnancy is going to impact that child's brain, probably for their entire life. So that puts another layer of responsibility, I think, on people who choose to have children. So we are also finding that epigenetics may also help explain the rage, the anger, or the depression that you often see in children who are adopted, who are abandoned, who were born with a surrogate, because during that 9 months, that fetus learns to be comfortable with the environment. It may not like it, but at least it's familiar. It knows the smells. It knows the tastes. It knows the type of core emotions that are in the mother based on what's happening to her. It knows what kind of food it's eating and so on. Now you take this brand new baby and you plop it into an entirely different environment. The smells are not the same. The tastes are not the same. The feeling of the body is not the same. And that does not feel safe to that little baby. And so the way they exhibit that is they're upset, they're angry. Where is what I grew up with for 9 months? It's not here anymore. And they might even go to a different country where the language is different, the temperature in the environment is different, the food is different, and so on. So they're doing a lot of research with that now. And here's one thing they found. If the parents have decided they cannot take care of this child and they're going to adopt it out, then they're asking the mother to send a piece of clothing that she has worn with that new little baby. The new parents cannot wash the clothing because it'll wash the odor out. But when that little adopted child now is sleeping with something that's familiar in smell, it helps it adapt to the environment a whole lot more. Who knew? I mean, 10 years ago, we learned that if you're buying a little 6-week-old puppy And you can get a blanket to go with that little puppy that the mother used. That puppy will adapt to its new home a whole lot better. But we had no idea the same thing happened with babies. So 70% is epigenetics. And that explains how some behaviors tend to run in families, how some diseases tend to run in families. You know, some family systems have more heart trouble. Some have more diabetes. Some have more heart disease. And we think it's epigenetics, the lifestyle and behaviors that your ancestors lived for back three or four generations that keep perpetuating those commonalities as the family systems go on. And we're learning what you can and can't do about this nature-nurture equation. You can do a lot. 70%, I hope I say it three or four times, 70% of how healthy you are and how long you live is epigenetics, not genetics. That's such good news. So you are a unique individual. We've talked about that. And who you are is a complex interaction of every part of you, your brain, your spinal cord, and your genome. If you don't know that word, it's your genetic inheritance, your chromosomes and genes. But it is your epigenome, and that's everything that's not genetics, plus your microbiome and virome. That's all the bacteria and the viruses that live inside your body. A lot of them are good. Some of them are bad. If the bad ones outweigh the good ones, you will get sick. And I love the way William Faulkner put this. Because of all of this, it means the past is never dead. It's not even past. You carry it with you in every cell of your body that has a nucleus. So I got a picture. Good. All right. So here's in the nucleus, here's the cell, here's the nucleus. This is what we saw before, the double helix, which is your chromosomes and genes, your blueprints. But there's something else in that cell that has now been recognized that we didn't know what it did. There's a whole bunch of protein strands. Those protein strands appear to carry the behavioral memories of your ancestors back three or four generations. You can pass that on to your biological children for three or four generations. And that's very biblical. If you read Kings, Judges, Chronicles, you'll often read something that goes like this. And the king did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the king died and was buried with his fathers. And his son came to the throne. And his son did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's not genetics. That's epigenetics. Following the behavioral patterns. So the more you can learn about your biological ancestors and how they lived and their challenges, the more you can understand when you get the urge to do something, then you have to ask yourself, does this meet my ethical and moral standards, and is it safe, and should I really do it? Because it may be cellular memory from one of my ancestors. At first, people think this is a little nuts, but it isn't. And then you'll read in the Bible something like, doesn't happen very often, the king did evil in the sight of the Lord and died and was buried with his father, and his son came to reign in his stead. And it was a Joash. Joash had a horrible generational background of evil. But Joash chose to do what was right. I'm interested in how that happened. He was 8 years old. And he said, we're going to get the old scripture out, and we're going to start reading it as a nation, and we're going to start acting a little better. So everybody has a choice regardless of their cellular memory, but know that you have it. So you don't choose your cellular memory. It comes to you with those two cells that start. But you do choose whether or not you want to act on an impulse that you're not even sure where it came from. That's where you have conscious choice and willpower. So I'll give you one example because it's always, I'll give you two examples of cellular memory because people kind of raise their eyebrows and go, is that real? Yeah, it's real. We're now seeing this a lot in individuals who receive an organ transplant, because when you get an organ transplant from another human being, you get that human being's cellular memory. So I was talking in Australia about cellular memory. We were just starting to learn about it, and this woman ran up to me at the break and said, whatever you do, don't leave when you're done, because I got to tell you something. But right now, I got to go call my brother and tell him he's not crazy. Okay, that was kind of interesting. So I said, okay, I'll wait for you. So after we were done that evening, this is the story she told me. She said, 6 o'clock, I was getting ready to come and listen to you, and the phone rang, and it was my brother. And my brother said, sis, how do I eat spaghetti? And she said, are you crazy? I'm getting ready to go hear some woman from America. I don't have time to talk about this. No, sis, he says, it's real. How do I eat spaghetti? She said, all right, you get your plate of spaghetti and you grab your knife and your fork and you cut it into little half-inch pieces and shovel it in. Can I go now? And he goes, how do you eat spaghetti? She goes, oh, for crying out loud. No, he says, how do you eat spaghetti? She said, I get a big spoon and a fork, and I twirl my spaghetti in the spoon, and I shove it in my mouth. Can I go now? Sis, he says, something really weird just happened to me. Really, really weird. He said, my wife fixed me spaghetti tonight for the first time in 3 months, and I sat down and I looked at my plate, and I said, there's something missing. No, she says, there's nothing missing. There's your knife, there's your fork. No, he says, something's missing. There's nothing missing. He says, I got up and I started walking around the kitchen and I started pulling open drawers. I didn't know what I was looking for. And I come to the silverware drawer and I see the nice big soup spoons and I say, oh, that's what's missing. He said, I went back and sat down, took the soup spoon, took my fork, started twirling spaghetti in my spoon and freaked out. That's why I'm calling you. 3 months before, she had donated him a kidney. The cellular memory on his kidney was prompting him to eat spaghetti in a different way. Lovely Baptist minister, living in the town where I lived. He had a heart transplant because he'd inherited some heart defects. When he got out of the hospital and recovered and came back stark working at his parish, he said every time he drove down Main Street, he'd pass the Green Lantern Saloon. And he'd have this overwhelming urge to go in and drink a pint. Okay, he'd never drunk alcohol in his whole life. Every time he went by the Green Lantern, he had to struggle not to go in. I wondered personally why I didn't drive down a different street, but maybe would have come to another pub, I don't know. So this goes by 2 or 3 weeks, and he is really feeling like he's losing his Christian experience. So he goes to see the surgeon. He said, I know they won't release information about where my heart came from, but I'm going crazy here. And he tells him about the Green Lantern. So the surgeon thought maybe it was worthwhile petitioning the transplant bank to see if they could get any information about where his heart came from. So they made a petition, and he explained to them that this was a minister, and he was really upset. He was losing his Christian experience and all of this. The word comes back from the transplant committee. We will not release the name, but we will tell you that your heart came from a 24-year-old young man who was killed in a drunk while driving accident. He's got cellular memory in his heart for drinking alcohol. But here was the interesting piece. The second he found that out, it never bothered him anymore when he drove by the Green Lantern, because he knew it was just cellular memory from somebody else that was urging him to stop and drink. Well, you got cellular memory in your body from your ancestors that may be triggering a desire to do things that in the end you decide were not good for you to do. Absolutely fascinating to me. I could tell you stories all day. Now, surgeons didn't used to tell their patients about this because they were afraid their patients would freak out and not want the transplant. Now there are entire books in the last couple years that have been written about that. Your food tastes can change. The kind of music you listen to can change. The kind of car you want to drive can change. So, fascinating. So, cellular memory may impact relationships. You like or you don't like them, and you have no idea why. But it's somebody in your last three or four generations that didn't like that kind of person, perhaps. Now, here's what, you know, the Bible really advocates that monogamy is the way to go. The United States doesn't practice monogamy. We're lucky if we do serial monogamy, not cereal that you eat, meaning S-E-R-I-E-L-A-L. I don't know how you pronounce how you spell it. I'm so messed up. I learned British spelling in Canada, came to the United States. I had red marks all over my papers because I'm spelling H-O-N-O-U-R, and America says the correct way is H-O-N-O-R. So I have really trouble with spelling, but that's okay. So now, where was I going with that? Because I just saw in my mind my test paper with red marks all over the place. Yes, serial monogamy, good. See, somebody always can tell me where I am. In the United States, a couple will get together and they'll become sexually active. And maybe they'll date for 3 months, 6 months, a year, they'll break up, now they'll start dating somebody else, and they'll become sexually active. And then they'll do that again and again, and eventually they'll decide to get married, and of course then they're expected to be monogamous. Well, the more you develop cellular memory for every single person you ever have sexual activity with, and the more different experiences you have, you start programming yourself for finding it very difficult to be monogamous. And that's very sad, because we've got sexual activity in the fifth grade, and I wonder how those people are ever going to develop a relationship and build the kind of relationship that happens when you're monogamous year after year after year. Cellular memory is more likely to be activated in an environment that resembles the one you were in when you developed the memory. Okay, for example, you decide that smoking marijuana would be a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea at all. Now, if you're dying of a horrible disease and you think you can get a little pain relief, you know, maybe, but you can have a psychotic break with one experience of marijuana. It does things to the brain that are not good, and we don't have time to go into that. But let's suppose that you're smoking pot and you're studying for an exam. Now, 2 weeks later, it's time for the exam, but you don't think it'd be a good idea to go to school stoned. So you don't smoke marijuana. You get in the test situation, and your brain will not remember what you studied because it was studied under the influence of marijuana. Now, experiments have shown if you started smoking marijuana in school right then and there, you'd start being able to remember what you loaded while you were under the influence of marijuana or alcohol or any other drug. And we had no idea that that's what happened. We also know that you are, when you hear the term deja vu, and people interpret that as a past life, you know, I lived back in the 1800s and whatever. No, probably not. Pretty sure not. But what may be happening is that cellular memory from somebody in your biological ancestry was somewhere that reminds your brain of this particular environment, and you think, I've been here before. I must have lived a past life. No, you probably have a relative that had been at that very spot or somewhere like that. And this is putting a whole different spin on cellular memory. My maternal grandfather emigrated from Ireland to Canada. He left from Cork. My Irish ancestors come from the northwest part of Ireland in a place called Achill Sound. That's not very affluent. My grandfather used to say, the only way for us is up. The houses all had peat floors, you know, came from a very primitive part. I decided I want to go to Ireland and to learn a little bit about my ancestors. So my cousin and I went to Ireland. And we wanted to go to Cork because we knew that's where my grandfather had sailed from. Actually, I've got relatives somewhere here in Australia. I haven't located them yet. My maternal grandfather, his parents died when he was 13. And there were no other family members that could take care of him and his younger brother. So they put him in a Dublin orphanage. If you've studied any history, you know that periodically some of those countries decided to clear out the orphanages. So my maternal grandfather was sent to Canada. His younger brother was sent to Australia. So I just had my DNA done because I'd like to find those Australian relatives. So I would love, his name was Caffrey. Alfred Brian Caffrey, very Irish. There's no mook on it because our particular generation won all their tribal fights. So if you won all your wars, they took the mook off and you're just Caffrey. So there's a Caffrey somewhere in Australia and I'd like to find him and, you know, have a little chat and see how much alike we are and so on. So we're learning stuff that makes much sense, great sense, in terms of biblical history, but we had no idea. So Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was an American writer, said that you are an omnibus in which your ancestors ride. He wrote that long ago before we had this research, and people would say, what do you mean you're an omnibus in which all your relatives are riding with you? Well, your brain and body is an omnibus, and you carry their cellular memory in every cell that has protein strands. Paul Pearsall, who runs the Heart Math Institute in the United States, that's discussing, that researching the connection between the heart, which is a subconscious organ, but which has neurons, and how it interacts with the brain, where you have lots of neurons. He said, once two systems come into energetic contact, all we are is energy. When you're out of energy, you die. All we are is energy. So when you come into contact with another energy field, and you can measure the energy field around a human being out about 15 feet, It's strongest within 3 feet, but you can measure our energy field. When two systems come into energetic contact, they are forever connected by the cellular memories of that connection. Experiences with parents and others close to you remain within you. That means I've got a piece of the reverend over here within me. I got cellular memory of our interactions. And when they're good interactions, that's wonderful. That's why you're happy to see people again, because your body and your brain recognize we had a good time with that person, and now we get to do it again. Fascinating. So when Scripture tells us what to think on and how to behave and suggests that we really want to learn to act like Christ acted, then that means that all the experiences with people close to you, with people you meet, with your parents, make sure they're pleasant, loving, and affirming, because you're building cellular memory and so are they. It's making me look at my life in an entirely different way. I want to build healthy, pleasant cellular memory. And the people I interact with, I always want our interactions to be pleasant, loving, and affirming. And to me, that's living Christ's life on this planet. Thank you.